Evening, I'm opening this meeting of House Committee on Revenue Tuesday, February 11th. We will consider the agenda items in the order in which they appear. I'm opening a public hearing, HJR 203. LRO.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. So House Joint Resolution 203, at the request of the governor, would take the current ban on real estate transfer charges that is in the Constitution and modify that to allow real estate transfer fees or charges if the property is in excess of $500,000. And the property would provide an exemption for the first $500,000. And then in addition to that, the revenues would go towards affordable housing programs as defined and discussed in the bill.
Thank you. We have a number of people signed up to testify, and I've already identified the first panel. This is Shannon, Isaac, and Emily. You will, of course, state your names for the record when you speak. The second panel will be Chris Bonner, Daniel Hauser, Dr. Sandoval. After that, we will hear from Sean Jillians, Samantha Bear, Anthony Smith, and then I'll announce the next one after that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, Vice Chair Reske. Please bear with me as I'm battling through a cold tonight. Thank you for the opportunity to come and speak about House Joint Resolution 203. This proposal would refer back to voters the ability for the state to impose a real estate transfer fee when the revenue raised is used for affordable housing. It has been reported a couple of different ways, so I want to clarify for the record. The first $500,000 would be exempt. This would mean that a sale of $650,000 could have $150,000 of that sale could be subject to the fee if the legislature decided to implement this. The governor is very invested in having these conversations. How will we fund the unmet need for affordable housing in our communities? I spent the last 13 years working in homeless services and housing in Portland, and the past 3 years in particular working towards both the Portland and the Metro housing bonds, really recognizing the need for affordable housing development dollars, and the issue far outpacing the demand of rent burden that our communities are facing. Additionally, I've spent the last 2 weeks in a number of House committees as you all are discussing a state of emergency around homelessness and conversations about the need for ongoing revenue to fund both shelters up to emergency or affordable housing and services. And so I think this is the opportune time to begin that discussion. And I will leave most of our time up here today to the rest of the panelists, but I'm happy to answer any questions as they come up.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Emily Ryman, and I'm here as the CEO of Dev Northwest. We're an affordable housing developer and community development corporation serving most of the Willamette Valley and Mid-Coast from Lane County up to Clackamas County. Dev Northwest was born out of the merger of two affordable housing entities last year, and one of the foremost goals of that merger was to be able to develop more affordable housing across more types of housing at a scale that would actually be meaningful during our historic housing crisis. We see the need as universal across our counties. We serve urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas. We develop rental housing and housing for ownership. And the statistics are equally alarming across all of those types of housing and across all of those geographic areas, from Creswell to Corvallis to Oregon City. But the resources Oregon has to build affordable housing are far too few and far from universal. Federal funding is flat or declining. Many traditional sources of funding favor large projects or specific populations, leaving out smaller projects or hard-to-serve populations, such as youth aging out of foster care. Shelters and transitional housing remain incredibly hard to fund. homeownership, which now has its very first source of funding from the state. That funding is quirky, and it's a drop in the bucket compared to the need that we have to serve prospective low and moderate income homebuyers across the state. What that means in practice is that we as affordable housing developers have to configure our projects to look a certain way, and to fit certain communities and to serve certain populations. But we know that the need is everywhere. House Joint Resolution 203 would enable not just a new source of funding for affordable housing, but it would enable a flexible source that can go to fit some of those unmet needs across the spectrum. Dev Northwest is also a homeownership center helping aspiring first-time homeowners, and I just want to take a moment to address how this might impact those clients, because I know there's concern about that. With the exemption that Shannon mentioned of projects under $500,000 or real estate transactions under $500,000, this isn't going to touch the low and moderate income families that we work. We're looking at families that are buying homes in the $180,000 to $220,000 range. Quite to the contrary, this funding source could potentially fund the development of a whole lot of new homes for ownership that would actually be in an affordable price range for those families. So Dev Northwest is here today to support 203 completely and urge its passage. Thank you.
Great. Hello. Thank you, Representative Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Isaac Judd, and I'm a broker in Eugene, Oregon, a real estate broker, and I own my own company for the last 12 years. And so I'm here to testify in favor of House Joint Resolution 203. I believe that this is an important step, as Emily and Shannon mentioned, of one of the steps that the state can do in order to combat the housing crisis in Oregon. My concerns, I do have some concerns. I want to make sure that in some of our metro areas where the beginning market for housing may start in the 400, 450 range in areas of Portland, I want to make sure that first-time homebuyers have an opportunity in those communities too to get their foot in the door. And I think we need to be mindful of that. And the transfer tax will ultimately be transferred to the new buyer of the home. That'll be a part of that price. But it's important to me, not only as a realtor, but as an Oregonian, that everybody has the right and access to housing that they need to live and thrive in our communities through opportunities like Emily is describing and also through home ownership. Since I come from the realtor's point of view, not speaking as a member of any association, but just for myself, I do think it's very important that we are mindful that homeownership is the main way that wealth is built in our communities, and we need to be mindful of that. And so if the state were to implement this tax, it's my belief that a good portion of this money should be used in a robust and easy to access down payment assistance program that would allow people who may be out of the housing market or be marginalized in the community, including our African American and Black communities and our indigenous communities, that we give them an opportunity to participate in the housing market that we've historically kept them out of. So I think that's important that we keep that in mind as we're moving forward. But also, you know, our lower income potential buyers, that we give them an opportunity to step onto this ladder and enjoy homeownership in our communities. And I think that if we use this wisely, I think that that can be a tool towards that end. Couple things I'll mention is the wealth gap between renters and homeowners is staggering. I checked these all today. Homeowners' median net worth is 80 times larger than a renter's median net worth as of 2015 statistics for the census. And so that means that unless we're able to give renters and marginalized communities a boost into the housing ladder, they may never, ever be able to reach the dream that many of us take for granted of homeownership. And they are going to be removed from certain conversations in regards to wealth in our community. A transfer tax is not enough. We will need to decide that we're prioritizing homeownership and give our neighbors the opportunity to have equity here in Oregon. As a realtor, I've witnessed countless transformations of lives through homeownership, along with the social stability that happens and comes with homeownership. I realize that my testimony before you today may be in conflict with some of my colleagues in the associations that I'm a member of, but I believe that this is an issue that's important, and it's a tool that we may be able to use in order to accomplish some bigger picture goals. And for that reason, I stand in support of this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We're going to hear from the second panel now. There are 18 people signed up to testify, and out of respect for everyone's time, yours, as well as the committee's, and the committee's been here since 8 or before this morning, I'd like from now on to limit testimony to 3 minutes a person, and that's usually enough time to express the points that you want to make. If there are other points you want to make and you have information available in writing, please feel free to submit your written testimony to our committee assistant over at the table here, and we'll get it put into the record. This panel is Chris, Daniel, Dr. Sundoval. After that, we will hear from Sean Gillian, Samantha Bayer, Anthony Smith. After that, it will be Ellen Miller, Sean Cleave, Fred Purdy.
Thank you to the committee and the chair for listening to this testimony on this important issue. My name is Chris Bonner. I've been a residential realtor for 30 years. Through the years, I've seen many attempts to stop this moving train, and clearly we have not been successful, as we are now officially in a housing crisis. I won't go into the signs of that, as I know there's been much time spent on that during the session. I just want to say that we need to make real and sustained investments in order to make sure every Oregonian has a place to lay their head at night. The real estate transfer fee is one way to do it. I'm here to say that it is my opinion it will not have a negative effect on the real estate market. And in fact, I would argue that this will improve our market, as folks don't like to live in or work in communities that don't appear to care for their citizens. I know that the Realtor Association will claim that this will hurt affordability, and this is sort of ironic, as by definition, this funding would provide affordable housing. In regard to the folks who will be paying this expense, they are the buyers and sellers at the top of the price range and would typically not be who I worry about when it comes to affordability. The question then becomes, if not this method of raising revenue, what? The challenges have only gotten worse, and there is no suggestion from the opposition as to how we will solve this. I think it's high time we have this conversation, be specific about what affordability looks like. No one can afford homes that aren't there. We need to build the homes that Oregonians need and help them stay in their homes, and we need to find the funding now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Reschke and Marsh, and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Hauser, Tax Policy Analyst for the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I respectfully submit this testimony in support of House Joint Resolution 203. Tax policy, as many of you well know, serving on this committee, has really important and significant implications for our communities, for our economies, and for our lives. How we structure our tax code impacts who pays the tax, rich or poor, white, black, or brown, and how much funding is available to provide the services Oregonians depend on. Good tax policy ensures that those with the most income and wealth pay more, and that racial inequalities in the distribution of wealth, public services, and income are addressed through our tax code. HJR 203's empowerment of the state legislature to create a state fee on the transfer of real estate passes both of these tests. Ownership of property is generally more concentrated in the hands of people logically with more income. This should come, hopefully, as no surprise. If you have more income, you often are then attracting more wealth. However, when you really look at and dig into the data on this information, it's quite striking. What we find in looking at the most recent national data is that the lowest earning 20% of families averaged a net worth of about $7,000, while the typical family in the top 10% had net worth of more than $1.6 million. What this means is that assessing a fee on the transfer of real estate property, which is a key component of wealth, is likely to be a progressive policy change. And keep in mind, by omitting, as was mentioned earlier, the first $500,000 in value, and this is a marginal effect, right? So if you have a $510,000 home, it's only that $10,000 that is being assessed, whatever the transfer tax is. But keep in mind that because of that, it's even more likely to be a progressive change in policy. Beyond that, the distribution of wealth in the U.S. is not just unequal based on people's incomes, but also based on their race. We have a long and unfortunately very racist history in America of layering tax, housing, and economic policies designed to build white wealth while exploiting people of color. And as a result, the median white household owns nearly 10 times the wealth of the median black household and more than 8 times the wealth of the median Hispanic household. White households are twice as likely to have equity in a business and significantly more likely to own a primary residence than both groups. And those are all areas where the implications and the actual tax incidence of assessing this fee on the transfer of real estate is likely to come into play. Those are going to be the people paying it. And so the data points really to a fee on the transfer of real estate being less likely to land on households of color on average than on white households. The means of raising revenue, just this tactic here of a real estate transfer tax, is going to have on its own a really positive impact on the progressivity and the racial equity of our revenue system. But when you then use those resources and invest them into affordable housing that is targeted at some of the recommendations from the Joint Committee on Addressing Racial Disparities in Homeownership or other really important needs we have in our system, the combination of raising the resources in a racially equitable and progressive way and then spending them to address our housing crisis is really positive. And so I would urge this committee to support House Joint Resolution 203.
Chair Nathanson and other committee members. For the record, my name is Gerardo Sandoval. I'm here to advocate for HJR 203. Just to give you a little bit of my background, I'm a professor of planning, public policy, and management at the University of Oregon. So I'm basically an urban planner. So I filter this issue through an urban planning perspective. And I serve the state in two capacities. I'm on the state's Housing Stability Council, and I'm also on the Land Conservation and Development Commission, so LCDC. But today I'm here as a concerned citizen of Oregon, concerned about this housing crisis. First of all, I want to thank you for making historical investments in affordable housing. I think that has to kind of be said. I could see the actual impacts in the city that I live in Eugene. Many times when you're in the city, you a lot of the actual development that's happening is through affordable housing. But we still need a lot more to be done. And I see HJR 203 as an opportunity, as a tool, another tool in approaching this issue. So when I was a student at UC Berkeley, one of my professors told me that in order to build affordable housing, you needed two things. So one was money, and the second thing was permission. So basically, that comes down to affordable financing and zoning and land use changes. And I think in order to tackle this issue, you really have to take a more holistic approach where you link increase affordable housing to land use and also to public transportation, especially if you're really interested in advocating equity issues. Secondly, we discourage housing development. This is a market-based solution, and it's interesting because it's really based on high-performing cities. Okay, so as the market kind of increases, you gain more revenue. This has also been implemented in other states, and the housing markets there have not collapsed. Also, the median income, family income for Oregonians is about $360,000. And so most Oregonians, definitely the ones that need the help, will not be impacted negatively by this. But I think at the end of the day, what you really have to think about is equity. And this is basically basically redistributing benefits of high-performing housing markets. So a lot of people have made money off of the high-performing housing markets, and it's just a matter of redistributing that so other folks can benefit from that market as well.
Thank you for being with us, all three of you. Let's move to the next panel. I'll Alan, Sean, and Fred are coming up next.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors in opposition to HJR 203. Certainly a pleasure to see several of our members here in Salem. We don't get an opportunity to connect with them all that often. I will mention that the official position of the association is opposition to this. When we made the determination of whether or not we would support Measure 79 back in 2012, which voters ultimately approved with almost 60% of the vote across the state, including passage in 35 of 36 counties in Oregon, we did a survey of our membership, and 90% of our membership supported the preemption on real estate transfer taxes. So I feel fairly comfortable in conveying the position of the association and its 17,000 members. I think we're all here, and we've been here working on housing issues for a number of years together. And we all agree that we need more housing. We all agree that we need more affordable housing, but we also agree that we need more market rate housing as well. You guys have heard sort of the number from the state economists that we're 155,000 units behind where we need to be for current population, and that will only increase as we have additional in-migration coming in from other states. And so we really have worked on projects like House Bill 2001 with the speaker of how we can increase infill development. We've looked at other affordable housing pilot projects. We've started to look at this. We've made significant investments in housing. In 2009, the association came together with affordable housing advocates and introduced the first document recording fee in Oregon. We supported that. We were the chief sponsors, actually, of the bill. It went in as the Housing Alliance, the Realtors, the Bankers, and I believe the Home Builders at our request. And we have increased that document recording fee significantly over the years. As Representative Kenny Geyer knows, we just put through a pretty significant increase. And that money goes 10% for homeless population, 14% for home buyers, down payment assistance, and 76% to rental properties. Rental properties is where I really want to touch on as we talk about this $500,000 threshold. When you're building significant multifamily projects, the type that we did not see for decades in Oregon, the cost of the land alone is significantly more than $500,000. And nationwide, you look at what transfer taxes are at, they range between 1% and 3%. You layer on then the gross receipts tax that we just passed, you're really starting to look at whether or not these projects will pencil and whether or not we're actually going to build these units. And so while we're talking about the building of wealth and home ownership, let's not forget that this real estate as rental units is an investment as well. On the single family side for new construction, I'll wrap it up super quick, Madam Chair. On the single family side, we see an acre of raw dirt in the Portland metropolitan area going for $800,000 an acre. Currently, that's before services are put in place or anything else, literally raw dirt. And so when you're talking about layering on additional taxation on top of that, and we already have the affordability, you simply cannot build a home that's affordable to most Oregonians. Last but not least, you did hear from testimony previously, the median home price in many communities across our state is over $400,000 now. That's the median average house in those communities. This threshold will start to impact middle-class Oregonians. Thank you, Madam Chair. Happy to answer any questions.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Samantha Baer, Associate Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau. By way of background, the Farm Bureau is the state's largest agricultural trade association, representing nearly 7,000 farm and ranch families across the state. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in opposition to HJR 203. I have also submitted testimony in writing, and I will try to be very brief today in my comments. While we appreciate the need to address the affordable housing crisis in Oregon, allowing a real estate transfer tax is not the right solution. Oregon's family farms are already struggling to create viable succession plans, and the number of farms qualifying for century farm status is declining.
allowing a tax on the transfer of real property will create substantial obstacles for the exchange of real property between generations of Oregon's farmers and ranchers. With the cost of farming and regulatory burdens increasing, younger generations of farmers already face steep economic barriers in replacing the older generation. In our eyes, this resolution will exacerbate these barriers by levying a tax every time property is transferred between generations, whether by gift, part of a living trust, or sale. Right now, Oregon can take pride in its family farms, which make up a vast majority of farming businesses in Oregon. But this resolution puts the legacy of these farms and ranches in jeopardy. Therefore, we urge you not to move it forward. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony Smith, Oregon State Director for NFIB, representing thousands of small businesses across the state, many being the smallest of small businesses. Please keep in mind that NFIB represents small businesses in every industry of Oregon's private sector. And although 90% of our members have fewer than 25 employees and 70% have fewer than 10 employees, the small businesses that we represent account for over 60,000 Oregon jobs. I'd like to share with you our concerns with HGR 203 and ask that you stand up for small businesses by opposing the resolution. As my colleague mentioned, just 8 years ago, with nearly 60% of the voters in Oregon passed ballot measure 79, which amended the state constitution to prohibit new real estate transfer taxes. And they did so to make sure that the legislature couldn't act on its own to repeal an existing state law at the time that prohibited these taxes. And with good reason, too, because legislation at that time was introduced on a fairly regular basis to roll back that prohibition prior to the passage of ballot measure 79. So clearly, the Oregonians wanted the legislature to steer clear of the issue, but here we are, and so I thought I'd mention just a few reasons why we shouldn't do that. First, Oregonians already pay significant taxes on property. Property owners, including small businesses, already pay significant property taxes to their local communities. And if they're in the business of buying and selling property for profit, they're also paying one of the highest capital gains taxes in the country. Adding another transfer tax to the equation would amount to a second or even a third layer of taxation simply for owning property. Secondly, businesses are already trying to deal with new taxes and additional costs. Just last year, we had the passage of the corporate activities tax, increased health insurance premium tax, newly created paid family and medical leave payroll tax that's going to go into effect in a couple years. We're still implementing a preset minimum wage increase schedule, and right now we're discussing a cap and trade program that could generate hundreds of millions of dollars in new revenue. Another new tax on real estate would make Oregon even less attractive to companies considering locating here, and those companies create jobs and invest in our community. Lastly, we should encourage business expansion, but real estate transfer taxes do the opposite by penalizing businesses for growing too big for their existing facilities. And the same is true for families that outgrow their starter homes. As property values rise, the real estate transfer tax that we're talking about will start impacting more and more property owners, resulting in another hardship for middle-class families and business owners. So for those reasons, we ask that you oppose HGR 203. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you all for your
testimony. Madam Chair.
Let's see, this is Ellen, Sean, and Fred. After that will be Laurie Wimmer, Karen Nettler, Annie Rose Shapiro.
Good evening, Chair Nathanson, members of the Revenue Committee. For the record, Ellen Miller here representing the Oregon Home Builders Association. I'm going to echo many of the comments that were made on the panel before me. We are here in opposition to this bill moving forward. We oppose sending a measure back to the voters. Less than a decade ago, the voters spoke on this issue, and we oppose HJR 203. I'm here tonight to represent the developer's perspective on housing affordability. We're very grateful for this legislative body's intent and efforts in putting money towards affordable housing projects, but we want to talk about the impact on housing affordability. So I want to walk you through a little bit what it would look like as far as a developer as they approach a project that might provide affordable homes for, let's say, 80 to 120% AMI. This transfer tax would have a very similar pyramiding effect as the CAT tax. So I want to walk you through this, that a farmer, let's just say a farmer were to sell to an investor some property. That investor would have to go through the entitlement process and the land use process, and then would sell that to a developer to build the infrastructure. So they pay the transfer tax would incur at that time. The investor would go through and would build out all of the infrastructure and then work to sell the lots to individual builders. It's possible at that time this transfer tax would then occur at that step. The builder may be building houses that are affordable, depending on the community, in the $180,000 to $300,000 range. This is not what would incur the transfer tax, but that cost of that house would represent the increase that that transfer tax added on to that house along those steps of the way. And in Oregon, we know that every $1,000 that is added to the cost of a home in Oregon, you disqualify about 1,800 individuals from qualifying for a mortgage for those homes. So I just wanted to speak on that, about maybe some unintended consequences of this transfer tax, and I will pass it on to next one. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Fred Purdy, and like an earlier person testifying, I'm speaking under the duress of a cold, so bear with me if I cough. I'm here to oppose this measure. I only learned about it yesterday, so I don't have a very organized presentation, but I feel it offends me in terms of my sense of fairness as well as unintended consequences. One aspect of it is that it seems like just another disguised attempt to put a sales tax on Oregonians in one form or another. It doesn't seem quite honest to me in that regard, when many Oregonians have voted for years and decades against having sales taxes. I feel it's unfair to burden those trying to buy or sell a home in one category of the population to favor another. Why not have an honest income tax of some kind? It can be a progressive tax, and I certainly support the need to provide more affordable housing. I've been a real estate broker in Oregon since 1976, and most of my business has always been with residential people buying and selling way under this 500,000 limit. So I'm not speaking really from a self-interest in this regard. And finally, on the unintended consequences aspect of my feelings, it seems to me those that are largely in the residential real estate provider part of the market, they're going to be apartment owners, and those are the people that are trying to provide and are providing rental housing now. So why punish those with an additional tax when they're the ones that are part of the solution that we need? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Taxpayers Association of Oregon. I'd like to first start by thanking this body for the investments they've made, especially you, Representative Geyer, working with the realtors over the years to find more state investments for affordable housing. I no longer work with the realtors. I did 5 years with them, and prior to that, I had 6 years with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I love two things. I love our open air and opportunity
opportunities in Oregon for the views through our farmland. I'm not a farmer myself, and I also love the opportunities we provide to live here through housing. When I look around and look at the situation that we're in and the 6 years that I did, 11 years I did both argue on both sides of the equation, I really just come down to the bottom line that we are the people who drive up costs. Not me, not just me, not just Ellen, not just members of this committee, but we bend over backwards to say we want to do something and then cripple it as we implement. We layer on layers of bureaucracy and find things that won't actually work in the end and say to ourselves, hey, we won because that person doesn't get to build the thing that we didn't like. I think if we really were realistic about addressing Oregon's housing problems, we would give executive order to the governor, or executive power to the governor to identify parcels of properties within urban areas or slightly outside of urban areas that could be developed quickly, that would be inclusive for a variety of incomes, and that would be the best bite of the apple that we could make for accelerating the housing that we need. It's just very frustrating to be somebody who sat on a work group to implement the pilot program that we did, that we came back to the assembly 2 years later to adjust because the box we put it in was too small to identify properties that would work. One of the cities that wanted to exercise the right under the pilot program to include more housing was the city of Hood River. And once we identified and removed all the layers of qualifications that we had put on, not only in statute to exercise this pilot program, but by rule, the one property in the Hood River area could not be built on because of the Columbia River Gorge scenic regime for protecting that land for scenic byways. So again, if we want to be serious about tackling the issue, I think we can do a lot to accelerate housing. We can be making investments in mobile homes, products that we haven't seen for years. And the reason for it is because we all are saying, I want something, but behind the closed doors, we're actually saying, no, I don't want that. And that's driving cost.
Thank you.
Thank you. Three.
This panel is Laurie Wimmer, Karen Nettler, Annie Rose Shapiro. After that will be Jordan Ort, Jody Weiser, Britt Conroy.
Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 45,000 members of the Oregon Education Association who are here today in support of HJR 203. We thank Governor Brown for proposing this resolution, which would exempt any real estate at or below the $500,000 level. This is a good threshold for limiting the one-time fee that a seller would pay, only for property transactions in excess of that value. Just 14 states, including Oregon, have no such charge for property transactions. Given Oregon's high escalating property values, now is the time to take advantage of our strong real estate market and use the fee revenue for affordable housing. The nexus between the high-flying real estate and the crisis of affordability could not be stronger or more appropriate. And you might remember that in 2012, we were exactly upside down. Of course, the voters saw that as an extra fee in a time that housing prices were declining. Our members are deeply concerned about Oregon's dramatic housing crisis now. They see that our young people suffer emotionally and educationally from unstable housing and houselessness. Fully 22,000 of our public school students are homeless, and that is an undercount, the official count. In fact, Oregon has the dubious distinction of having the highest rate of houseless youth in the United States. Other facts that lead us to advocate for this resolution are that nearly 40% of our 1.5 million households earn at or below 80% of median family income, challenging their ability to be housed. Only 22 affordable rental housing units are available for every 100 people who have incomes below the threshold of 30% of that median income threshold. Of 293,000 total households in Oregon needing housing help, just 51,000 of them are able to access rental assistance through our federal Section 8 program. Our most vulnerable people, the elderly, the disabled, mentally ill, and our children, need our help. We urge you to pass this referral to the ballot so that Oregonians may reconsider adding this revenue source to Oregon's affordable housing resources. Thank you.
And committee members, thank you so much for having us this opportunity to testify in support of HJR 203. My name is Annie Rose Shapiro, and I'm a residential realtor in Portland, a homeowner, and a member of Proud Grounds Advisory Board. My observation of clients over the years is that a marginal tax such as this would not impact their decision to sell or purchase a property. This will impact the diversity and health of our community by ensuring that more Oregonians have the safe, stable housing every human being deserves. Each new Proud Ground homeowner has the stability they need to thrive, but not only for themselves. Housing stability allows folks to provide safety net housing to others in their community, thus magnifying the impact these housing dollars have. We have a responsibility to right the wrongs of structural racism and discrimination that have denied so many in Oregon this basic opportunity for care to care for themselves and their community. As a realtor, I see firsthand the impact homeownership and stable housing has on people's lives. And again, I see my low-income homeowners purchasing so they can provide that safety net housing. Last Friday, I got to give keys to Aaron and his mother, Diane. Aaron is transgender, they're both disabled, and they've been living in a friend's garage for 2 years. Their third bedroom is earmarked for others in their low-income community who find themselves in housing stability. Someone who is purchasing a home that costs over $500,000 doesn't have the social network Aaron does, and therefore can't provide a couch for a dishwasher who got sick, couldn't work for 2 weeks, couldn't pay rent, and lost their apartment. I urge you to pass this measure and give Oregonians like Aaron the power, the dignity, and the resources to care for their families and communities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Karen Nettler, and I'm a board member of the Oregon Coalition of Christian Voices. Appreciate the opportunity to bring that faith perspective. We advocate for laws that look out for the well-being of all in our communities. And our faith traditions tell us to measure the success of our laws and policies by how well those most at risk are doing. I drive I-205 in Portland most days. So most every day, I see the tattered shelters of the houseless along the freeway. I never get used to it. On the contrary, I'm increasingly distressed as I see what we as a society are tolerating, and they're just the most visible of so many in our communities who are experiencing homelessness and housing insecurity. That so many in our communities are without safe, affordable homes is a violation of what is acceptable in a just and healthy society. We can't afford to get used to it, and we do know we have an emergency. You'll likely hear from groups who are opposing this resolution with their various reasons why it is a bad idea, but our faith traditions say the prosperity of those with the most power and influence must not come at the expense of the most vulnerable. So we believe this is a good idea. Should this resolution become law, those who are well off enough to be affected by it will not experience an emergency. It's an emergency in when even those who are working full time don't have the security of having enough to pay for housing. It's an emergency when children experience the trauma of frequent moves and insecure housing. It's an emergency when the disabled and elderly are literally living in tents and tarps and in doorways and struggling to attend to their most basic health and hygiene needs. We are grateful for the measures taken so far by the government entities and other groups that are contributing in ways that they can with nonprofits and faith organizations. And we support the effort evidenced in this resolution to bring all our citizens and groups to the table to be a part of the solution. For we are indeed one community, and when one of us is not well, none of us are well. We urge you to pass HJR 203. It's an important step in restoring a measure of safety and dignity to our most vulnerable neighbors. Thank you.
Thank you, Hall. Next, we will hear from Jordan, then Jody, then Britt Conroy, who is the last I have on the list to testify.
Might be my size, too.
Good evening, Chair Nathanson and the committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Jordan Ortz. I'm a mother of two, and I've been a realtor in the Willamette Valley for over 8 years. I'm here to oppose HJR 203. The sales price of $500,000 currently in Oregon, especially in the Portland and Eugene areas, and acreage properties around Salem is not unheard of. Property owners already pay more than their fair share of taxes to support their communities. This bill doesn't say how much the tax is going to be or how affordable or what the affordable housing programs will be either. While I believe that we need to come together and find solutions for affordable housing, bills like this want to continually take money from hardworking Oregonians. These people work for their money and pay income taxes. Now you're saying they don't deserve it and that someone else does. This is a classic case of robbing Peter to pay Paul, and we all know that if this is passed, it will only be a matter of time until the sales prices are lowered, the limits are lowered, and you'll want a higher tax because it always happens. Well, I'm happy to still see a bill that finally gets the opportunity to go to the voters, and that's only because it has to. The people have already told you we don't want this. On that note, I'd like to know if this does get passed, how much money of our tax dollars are you going to spend in order to promote this on the ballot when we already told you no? Please vote no.
Vice Chair Marsh and members of the committee, Jody Weiser speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. We generally support any measure that would broaden the legislature's ability to consider various means of taxing in order to have adequate revenue for the state. And the state constitution should not have prohibitions in it that restrict your ability to do that. It's too bad we have a system that allows things to happen like happened in 2012. And this restriction was put into the ballot because it's not the kind of thing that it should be in the constitution. Of course, any tax is not popular, but schools, parks, roads, hospitals, and getting the homeless off our streets is a popular idea, and we need to look at all the options for how to pay for it. On the other hand, we think this resolution is a heavy lift for the coming November election. We already have a really important measure on the ballot with the tobacco and vaping tax measure, and there are, depending upon you where you live, any number of important bond issues that will also be on that ballot. And there hasn't been a lot of attention given to how this bill is designed. So we advise you to move with caution this session, but put this idea in the mix of ideas for funding mechanisms to be considered in 2021. We wish there were a revenue caucus in this legislature, the way there is a craft brewing caucus, because there should be a group of people who are meeting regularly year-round to think of what's the next way we go to create a more fair system. Oregon is one of few states that doesn't have a transfer tax. The rate varies from 0.11% to as high as 4 or 5%. And there are many variations on how the taxes are done. Unfortunately, my computer's not sending email today, and so my testimony didn't make it. But when it does, there are a couple of items in there. One that shows how much various states impose just on a simple map. That's pretty current data, and another that's rather old data from 2005 was the most recent I could find that showed all of the variations. But in some taxes, in some states, The law is that the tax would be paid by the seller. Sometimes it's paid by both buyer and seller. Sometimes the amount of the tax goes up in steps, like a graduated income tax. Sometimes first-time home buyers are omitted from any tax or are taxed only maybe a half of the regular amount. Sometimes the amount is a certain amount shared between states and the state and county. So there's lots of ideas that should be looked at. And this is an idea that shouldn't be in the Constitution, and we urge your consideration. Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Britt Conroy, and I serve as Public Policy Director at Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. EMO is an association comprising of 15 denominations and over 115 congregations, organizations, interfaith partners, connecting hundreds of thousands of diverse members of the faith community all across the state. EMO supports HGR 203, which proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution authorizing a new state real property transfer charge. The EMO's board support for adding this revenue option to our state's housing policy toolkit stems not simply from the perspectives of board members as faith leaders from across the state, but also as managers of an organization that offers housing to homeless youth, housing support to survivors of domestic violence, affordable housing directly through low-income housing in North Portland, and housing to newly arrived refugees who start new lives through our SOAR refugee resettlement program. Across the state, we see daily what Oregon's housing crisis looks like for our communities, particularly children and youth who are experiencing homelessness. Oregon has the highest rate of K-12 homelessness in the country, with 1 in 6 of these young people being homeless and separated from their parents. Even school district staff shop for sleeping bags and tents to give to houseless students and families because we have failed to invest sufficiently in housing supports for those most in need. Sleeping bags and tents. In Tillamook County, we have heard repeatedly that school bus stops have been permanently established alongside rural patches of forest where families are living in tents. And nationally, as many as 50% of youth aging out of foster care become homeless within a few years. So on behalf of our clients and in embrace of our responsibility for one another, we thank this community for considering HJR 203. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, all three, and thank you, everybody, for your good, heartfelt, and full of information testimony tonight. Again, if you had anything in writing that you had not already submitted, you are welcome to leave it at the desk with the committee assistant. And I believe that concludes the list of everyone who had signed up to testify.
Could I just say something?
Yes, indeed.
Thank you. I just want to thank everyone for testifying. I want to thank the governor for putting this up for consideration. It's incredibly important, and we've talked about it a lot in the Housing Committee as well for years. We have been putting increasing amounts of money and trying to beg from general fund, from increasing the doc fee. Thank you to the realtors and others for helping with that, to more lottery bonds, more general obligation bonds. And still we are so pitifully short, and our numbers continue to increase of both the number of homeless, the number of unsheltered homeless, the number of people who are severely or even severely rent burdened. We are at 46th in home ownership in the United States. So at every single level, we're falling far short. And there are 35 states that have this. Roughly half have it as a state tax, and roughly half have both state and local options. So we are one of 15 that don't. I think we're one of only 6 that actually ban it in the Constitution. And I just want to remind people that there are all kinds of opportunities. If we removed the ban with certain parameters, there are all kinds of opportunities to look at exemptions for small family farms, multifamily housing, affordable housing, whole variety. This doesn't say that we're going ahead and implementing the tax. It just says we're trying to release the shackles that have kept Oregon in really a very challenging place to find funding for housing. So I want to thank you for having the hearing. I want to thank the governor for putting this on the table. I want to thank people for coming and testifying.
Thank you. Representative Vinod.
Madam Chair, I see that there's a subsequent referral to Rules Committee, so our committee will just send it over to their committee, and they'll ultimately get to decide if it moves forward. Is that correct?
we've scheduled the first step, which is the public hearing, and then we'll figure out the second step.
Yeah. Well, I hope that we move it to the next step and allow for the revenue committee to have, I mean, not the revenue, the rules committee to have a discussion around this.
Thank you. Any other comments? Thank you, audience. Thank you, committee. That closes the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 203. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 4009 for purposes of discussing amendments. And as we've explained, we put those words on the agenda intentionally, and that's exactly our intent. We're going to discuss some stuff. We're not taking any actions tonight.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So now in OLIS, you have the dash 3 and the dash 6, which were up there the other night. The dash 10 and the dash 13 are the updated versions of the dash 1 and the dash 2. And the dash 12, which we just got this evening, is something different relating to coin and metal dealers. So within OLIS, there is a document entitled Amendments in Progress. And that is just a kind of cheat sheet. And I was briefly just going to touch on the dash 10 and the dash 13. And it has the policies that were described yesterday. In that handout, it just links the concept of the policy to the location in the amendment. So unless there's, I don't know that you want me to go through every line because the topics haven't changed from yesterday. They're just in there. The dash 10 is clarifies a reference to the vehicle privilege tax, the returns and allowances piece. The biggest change in this is the clarification to the subtraction calculation in addition to the apportionment, which links apportionment to either DOR rule or the single sales factor or other specialty formula, depending on the industry. The other piece here on the penalties, it gets reduced to 5%. There's a safe harbor calculation, and the 80% threshold is extended for another year. This one still probably needs some work, especially for the first year, because the concept of a safe harbor calculation, it relies on the prior year tax liability. And of course, during the first year of the tax, that doesn't exist. So I think that still needs some work. We're still getting input from stakeholders about what might that sweet spot be. There was some discussion of allowing, including language that allowed DOR to reduce the penalties. They already have that authority elsewhere in statute, so it's not needed in here specifically. Then the dash 13.
Before you move to dash 13, let's stay on dash 10 for a minute. As you pointed out, this is similar to the amendment we just heard. It's just improved wording in most cases. But I'd like you to explain again how the words in the dash 10, the subtraction calculation, is looking now.
Okay.
To be just pretty careful about this.
So the dash 10 starting, now the calculation there starts on page 1, line 5. And it starts off by deleting some language in the introduced version on page 8. And there's some reordering of the section. So I'm looking at lines 6 through 10 of the dash. I'm referring to the dash 10. These are items that are not need to be excluded from the calculation. That is not new language. It's just reordered in the section.
Okay.
And then we get, starting with line 11, we get some language, and this is the new area, or it gets reworked a little bit, and it gets at the apportionment piece. So for any taxpayer having commercial activity both within and without the state, so these are the multi-state businesses. And as we've talked before, the subtraction for these larger companies that operate in multiple states needs to be apportioned somehow down to Oregon. And this version of the language, the key options there are in lines 15 through 18. Line 15
says as provided in ORS 314-650 and 314-665. That's the single sales factor. So that's where that points to, so a taxpayer can use the single sales factor. 16 and 17 refer to alternative apportionment, because there are some companies, depending on their unique circumstances, their apportionment might be different. So that's where they're picked up here. And then in line 18C, as provided for by the Department of Revenue by rule, this incorporates the concept that DOR has put forth in the rulemaking process. If that works better for a taxpayer, then they can choose that method. Basically, this gives the taxpayers the choice of which apportionment method. Arguably, the DOR method may be more pure in terms of the calculations within the corporate activity tax, but the single sales factor should be a pretty good proxy, and it's a figure that companies have already calculated, and they can just basically grab it from a tax return.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So, yeah, I guess the one other piece of that I should point to on page 2, lines 9 through 13, that the intermediate piece deals with some unitary group information. But on lines 9 through 13 on page 2, it points to the fiscal year piece. This has been referred to as the fiscal year issue. And so the corporation, the CAT is a calendar year basis. A corporation will have a different fiscal year. This basically allows them to grab the single sales factor, for example, as well as some of the other information related to the subtraction from that most recent tax year.
Okay.
Any other detail on that? And as I mentioned, the penalties still need some refining.
Okay. Representative Rushton, is this where you wanted to ask the question?
Let's let discussions happen first. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, the dash 13, this is the one that has some very technical changes. The word business revenue is changed to commercial activity in one of the items of areas that is not commercial activity. The state tax refunds, that all state tax refunds are not commercial activity. It has the auto dealership language removal about the specific customer when one dealership sells to another. And then unrelated business income points to the Internal Revenue Code for some definitions. Before it just said generically is taxable, and so now we point to the IRC. The most significant piece in this amendment is that last bullet, the fifth bullet, where I've listed it as excluding foreign entities with no connection to Oregon from the unified group. So just to speak to that a little bit, on the dash 13, it starts on page 1, line 11, and then basically goes through the end of the bold language on page 2. So conceptually, what we're talking about here are unified groups where you have multiple companies that operate as a single company, so they file together as one return, and that's the unitary group. And there are definitions about what defines that. The issue is that some of these very large companies, that they'll operate throughout the world. And part of the policy intent of the corporate activity tax, in that it is a different tax from an income tax, is to bring into the tax base any company that sells goods or services into Oregon. And this will include some foreign companies that sell into Oregon. So that is, by definition, part of the tax base. But what gets caught up in that, in this unified group, will be foreign companies that have no connection to Oregon. They may not even have any connection to the U.S. But within the unified group concept, they are part of this worldwide company. And so what this language gets at is the ability to exclude these foreign companies that have no connection whatsoever to Oregon. It won't affect the tax base because they don't have any sales of goods or services into Oregon. And administratively, it would be quite the headache to have them included, and it could just be very complicated. So the idea is to remove them from the group. the stakeholders are working on this, and this is the language that I think folks agree on. These are just out today, so we're still waiting to hear back from all stakeholders. And the approach here, part of the discussion has been whether or not to put very detailed language in statute or go with a rulemaking authority approach. And given the time right now, this is kind of that rulemaking authority approach. So depending on how that goes throughout the year, we may be back in 2021 putting things in statute from the rulemaking process. But that concept is simply just to exclude these foreign companies, by foreign as in non-US, that have no bearing and basically don't touch Oregon in an economic sense.
Okay. Questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Chris, I'm hoping you can help me get my head straight around the car dealership part of the bill. I understand what the changes is suggesting is that an exchange of cars among dealerships doesn't have to be associated with a specific customer request. But is this still a cash exchange between the entities? If I'm car dealer A and I sell a transfer a car to car dealer B, am I getting cash for that transaction?
That's my understanding of the nature of the transaction. So you have a dealership in Ashland and I have a dealership in Salem, and I want to get more. I think we were going with orange cars the other night, mm-hmm. or morning.
No.
And that's my understanding is that I would buy these from you, so there would be that cash exchange, I guess. And normally, on the face of it, it would look like a sale. So then that would count as a gross receipts. But as long as it's done for the purposes of customers, then it would not be counted. Now, the language that's in there was this notion of, I have a particular customer that comes onto my dealership and is looking for a specific car. And then I would, and I don't have it on my lot, but you have it on your lot. And I would buy that. This change makes it a little broader so that it doesn't have to be for a specific customer.
And I'm struggling with that because I'm trying to understand why that isn't a commercial transaction. If I am selling a car to another dealer, if I'm passing it through and there's an exchange because there's a customer who needs the orange thing, then that makes sense to me because there's that's sort of the final destination essentially of the transaction is that customer. But if I'm just selling it to another dealership because they want more green cars, why should that not be counted as a transaction? I suspect that there are other equivalent transactions in other sectors where people exchange products between entities for preparation for the open market.
I think it is a policy call, mm-hmm. in terms of whether or not the committee chooses to move forward with that. It could be that, I guess, in thinking about it, it's kind of a shuffling of inventory, mm-hmm. within the sector as opposed to the cars coming into the state. But it is, at the end of the day, I believe it's a policy call.
And it has been suggested that it's, as you point out, a shuffling of inventory, sort of like trading who has what. At some point, those dealers acquired cars from manufacturers or some other intermediate layer. At some point, they came into Oregon.
Right. And that could be triggering that commercial activity at that point, and then ultimately, when they sell it to an Oregonian.
Mm-hmm. Representative.
So just my perspective on this. So mm-hmm. it's a dealer trade. So the dealer is trading for that vehicle. He's using cash, so there's a monetary transaction. But the CAT tax will be applied to the end user who buys it from the dealer that traded for that. So if you actually ask for the CAT tax to be applied when the dealer is trading, it's going to be taxed twice. So the value of that product is going to have to go up again. So I think it's a double taxation if you tax for that dealer trade. Just my perspective. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to do some thinking on that because I'm not sure in the course of doing business, I'm not yet convinced that that's not commercial activity. I mean, there's a lot of cases where people buy something, prepare it, and resell it to someone else. So where, you know, if we are counting commercial activity, I'm going to
have to come up with a better rationale than I have quite yet.
Any other questions or comments on these two amendments? Because it's getting late, I don't want to start work on additional amendments tonight. But this is redoing, this is the improved language over something that we had already started. So dash 10, dash 13, yes, Representative Reschke.
And just in the penalty phase, again, just I'm gonna put on the record that what I'd like to see is some sort of grace period by DOR. So if somebody's really trying and they don't get to 90% of what they owe, that they don't get dinged the full 5% right up front, that there is, I'd like to hear from DOR at some point what their intent is as far as, I don't know the term, but basically a grace period here in the first couple of quarters as we implement this tax.
DOR is here.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And like I said, I think the other day in the hearing is that we have ability to write rules currently for when we won't impose the penalty and when we will waive the penalty. We are in the process, as you know, we've done almost a couple of dozen rules at this point. We still have more to do. That is one that the programs are considering. Grace periods are a little tricky because if those are published like that, then no one will follow the due date. So that is something that we have to weigh carefully. I think that we're looking more at the facts and circumstances of each taxpayer and whether they, you know, what their attempts were at actually trying to comply, whether they made any attempt at all versus really got close and maybe are. There's a lot of factors, and we're still considering those things, but we'll share them as soon as we have more information. But that is not one of the ones that we're working on right now. We're still working on the rules for financials and insurers and some other really complex rules at this point. Sorry, I don't have more for you.
No,
but that is definitely good. We're definitely being considerate of those things.
Because it is a new tax. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. There's something that may help. It would help me if you would put on the record. You mentioned you already have the authority to not assess a penalty or waive a penalty.
That is correct.
To change a penalty? Like, can you reduce one? Or is it just
Madam Chair, we absolutely. In revised statute 305-229, it says the department may adopt rules to not impose a penalty that would otherwise be imposable. And we've been very judicious in using that one. But also in 305-145, it gives us authority to waive penalty for good and sufficient cause, for first-time offense, or for the long-term effectiveness and health of the tax system. Most of our rules are under that one. And in that case, the rules that we currently have for penalty waivers for, like, for example, the 100% failure to file penalty for income tax purposes. If a taxpayer comes forward on their own and does everything that they're supposed to do but for filing late, then we'll waive 70% of the penalty. If they file after we've reached out and said, hey, you need to do this, we'll waive less. So we have authority to waive all or part of the penalty under current law for all of our programs. Those are our generic statutes.
Do you have any statistical information on how many times you do waive entirely or partially? And I'm thinking not so much as individual taxpayers this is hard because of pass-through income. There are individual taxpayers who are paying business, basically as a business income. But do you have any information that can assure us that you actually use the authority you have, that you have reduced or waived penalties?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we certainly do have transaction codes all in our system. I am not as familiar with our new system as I was with our old system, but we track them based on the type, even at least we used to track them based on the type of waiver, whether it was good and sufficient cause or long-term effectiveness or like a circumstance beyond the taxpayer's control kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's like, you know, fire destroys everyone's records and they're suddenly subject to these really hard penalties, and we waive in those cases too. Generally, advice of on a basis of a practitioner is not always a reason to waive, unless there's really no reason that the taxpayer should understand or otherwise know. There's a lot of criteria there, and we do have it. I just don't know how readily available it is. I'll ask, and we'll follow up for you. But we do waive them all the time, for all our programs.
Well, for right now, since you've stated it on the record, I'll take your word for it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else?
Okay.
We've completed our work on reviewing the amendments for tonight. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you all. I'm closing tonight's work session on House Bill 4009. There's nothing else on agenda, but we will see you tomorrow morning.
Right? Bright and early. Wow.
Right?
All right.
Okay. We're adjourned.
8:30.